When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Good evening and welcome to the Monday Night Euro Review Show by the Anglo-Italian Pod. As always, my name is Rory and I'm joined by my very good friends,
Adam and
Ben. How are we doing, everyone?
How we doing, boys? Ben, how we doing? Nice weekend, good weekend, quiet weekend?
Yeah, nice quiet weekend. Not much to talk about from an England perspective, was there this week? Bit of a quiet one. No topics of debate that made front page news or anything like that. It was nice to just sort of, you know, keep out the headlines and have a, you know, and then follow it up by a really entertaining game on Saturday as well.
Couldn't have asked for better, honestly. Couldn't have asked for better.
Yeah.
I'm sure we will get onto the debate. God, Adam, how are you doing? Even the thought of it has made me angry. How are you doing, man?
It's strange, isn't it? The hope that kills you. And that's what I'm kind of enduring right now, because Poland gave me hope on Thursday night. And we go into tomorrow's game needing a win. But the reverse psychology on this is if we win, we face France, Austria, and a group of death, essentially. I can't remember the fourth team, but
I think it's the Netherlands.
I think it's
something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah,
something
Netherlands,
like
I
that.
Think.
So yeah. It's going to be one of those that do I bother? Do I care about us? Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, it's a strange weekend. But nonetheless, all good here, all good. Very, like you say, very calm here at the moment as we kind of see the final third of the season. 2 weeks away from seeing Wickham at Wembley as well. Bloody
wow.
Hell, that's crept up. Yeah. That's crept up. So lots to get into, mate. But how are things in Milan? It was very sunny down there from what I can see.
It was absolutely beautiful. I was sunbathing all day yesterday, met Tommy, had a few beers in the park. It was
nice.
Beautiful. It really feels like summer's hitting, which is great. But I was saying like pre-pod that I think this weekend has been like just a perfect welcome break. And I was saying this to the missus and she was like, you're so dramatic. I was like, look, players need a break. Us supporters need a break.
Yeah.
I know that whatever happens at the end of the season, it's going to be horrible and torturous and I'm not going to enjoy a minute of it. So I needed this one weekend to just be like, football doesn't exist. I can just, you know, live peacefully before we go into whatever is going to happen over the next couple of months. But yeah, short answer, pretty good. There is a lot to talk about, I think, this evening. So we're going to be talking, of course, about England versus Brazil. Endrick, we've all seen him on Football Manager and FIFA, but now most of us have seen him in real life. We'll be talking about France versus Germany. We'll do a little bit of a chat on Italy stateside. Nobody seems really happy about that. We'll talk about a few of the international friendlies. And of course, as Adam is rocking his Poland shirt, we'll be talking about the playoff finals for Euro 2024. Some really interesting matchups there. So let's just get into it, I suppose. And let's go with Endrick announces himself. Now, this is a player that I've only really seen YouTube highlights of. I've had to believe how good he is from people on Twitter. And it was nice to actually see him come on the pitch. It's a bit mad. He's built like a barrel, right? He's like tiny, but he's so, so wide. And it only took him 4 minutes of being on the pitch to get the opening goal, I think. But I think the main issue here for me, and maybe the wider issue, is I'm going to go, Ben, I'm going to go to you. the defending, I think there's been a lot of chat around England and who stops this team from winning the tournament. Well, who stops this team from winning the tournament is the defence, I think. Yeah. What did you think of the performance in general before we praised Brazil? Do you think, are you as concerned as me about the defence and how solid or unsolid we looked?
Well, yeah, it's a tricky one because it was Lewis Dunk that came on that made the mistake that led to the goal, right? His header. And it didn't, it was very messy. It didn't look great. And there were times where Brazil, I think, got through England a little bit too easily. Obviously, it was unfortunate for Kyle Walker to go off injured as well, which kind of upsets the balance of that back line. You take the experience out of it, but you've still got, you know, you've still got Stones in there. You've still got, I think Maguire did start, didn't he? I think
he
alongside Stones, yeah. I think what was really alarming was I was chatting to my old man about this today. When you take Luke Shaw out of that England back line, and it's always a worry because of how injury prone that he is, the drop off to Chilwell is huge.
Yeah.
And I've always kind of been of the mindset that I don't think Chilwell is quite as good as people maybe say he is. I think he's a bit of a system player. I think he very much suits playing in a back three, which England might well operate in the summer. And I actually think, part of me, I know three at the back doesn't sound sexy, but I actually think in terms of some of the players that we do have, I think it's a good way to get the best out of some of them. But I'd still be picking Luke Shaw over Chilwell every single day of the week. And I think his performance was quite alarming, really, like alarmingly bad on Saturday. And I wasn't too worried about the defence as a whole, because I think a lot of what looked bad was individual mistakes from players that aren't necessarily in form, or Lewis Dunk coming off the bench and making that mistake. But I think, again, with Dunk, there's always been a bit of a clamour for him to play for England. And I think it just shows you that even when you can play week in, week out for a Premier League side, be the captain, be the main man at Brighton as he has for so long, the step up to international football is still massive. And I know the Premier League is probably the highest level of football in the world. And then you play in the Champions League and all those kind of things, and the Champions League goes up a level from that because you've got the best teams playing from elsewhere. But in terms of a consistent league format, the Premier League has always been the best over the last however many years. Mm-hmm. And I think that still shows that the step up from that to international football is still quite steep. And I think some of these players maybe get found out a little bit at that level. Also, where it's a friendly, I think it's quite hard to take those, a lot of serious conclusions from it. It's one of those ones where you watch the game and it was very uninspiring to watch, but you kind of walk away and just forget about it. You don't really care. I don't know if you thought the same, but I wasn't too bothered about the result. It was more just like, and especially as well with some of the players that were missing, I thought Gallagher was really poor in midfield. Mm-hmm. And I think I've kind of been thinking about, you know, when it gets to this kind of time of year before you're on the eve of a tournament, you always start thinking about, what would my 11 be for the first game in the Euros in the summer? And I was trying to think of like a way, trying to balance that midfield, who would be the best. And Gallagher was a name that like sort of kept coming to me, but that performance wasn't particularly encouraging at all. But I think it was just a really sloppy, poor display from England all around. I felt sorry for Ollie Watkins, really, who didn't really have a sniff at all. And I think, again, that just shows you that when you've got, you kind of almost take Harry Kane a little bit for granted with England sometimes, because you know, people will say that, I know obviously he's England's all-time record goal scorer, but sometimes I still don't think he gets the respect he deserves for England. I always felt, though being a Spurs fan, there's an element of bias in that, and obviously he doesn't play for us anymore. But with Spurs, you felt like you were kind of constantly having to defend him. And even with England, it feels a bit like that. I just don't think, and I think the drop-off from him then to Watkins and Tony, even though they're two fantastic strikers, is massive, because Kane can make things happen out of nowhere, whereas Watkins isn't that sort of striker.
So
it was a bit, it was just a bit, especially off of the back of all the conversation in the week about everything else, it was just a little bit really, really flat. Really flat.
Yeah, well, I think
it wasn't enjoyable.
I think what concerned me, like, obviously I don't care about the result. I, like, it's a 1-0. It easily could have been 0-0 in a competitive game. Paketa gets sent off. Like, I don't think it's
that. 100%.
Like, if you know what I mean, I don't think it's like the result isn't the thing. What concerned me was the performance. I think, like, and even though players, like you said, like Gallagher, that aren't necessarily going to be first choice, or Chilwell, who aren't necessarily going to be first choice, were making mistakes, Harry Maguire, who is going to be first choice, if it wasn't for Pickford, Brazil score twice. Like, within 5 minutes, he gives away the ball pretty sloppily when he gets caught in possession. And without Pickford, that's a goal straight away. And I think it kind of concerned me that, like, there still seems to be this soft underbelly to the England team that no one kind of seems to admit. And like, when I've seen these people go, oh, well, the France team and England team is exactly like a level inability, I don't think they are, because the French defense is so much better than ours. The goalkeeper, I like Pickford. He's never done anything wrong for England. He's always been reliable. But Maignan or Bryce Samba, who they had against Germany, is a better goalkeeper, better shot stopper, better with his feet. So I think that there is still this concern for me that you take one person out of that defence, you take Shaw out of that defence, as you said, and the whole thing seems to look very shaky. Mm-hmm. Like, and even we've gone from a team where like we could have a starting 11 of right backs to now like Kyle Walker, and if he's not there, you've got Kieran Trippier, who's had an awful, awful season. Like, he's not had a good season.
No.
And then Ben White, who's not getting picked, right? And it's like, who's next, right? And I think they're just, the defence concerns me. I felt like the way Southgate played, and I know we have a go at him for not being attacking enough, but I felt like, and Declan Rice, I know I'm biased, but he was England's best player on the pitch, right? He was fantastic. But him on his own in that midfield, it just wasn't possible for him to do. He needed more support because Declan Rice also, now he's at Arsenal and the role that Arteta has him played in, he likes to bomb forward a bit. And it just felt like he was being held back a bit and also not supported. So then Bellingham, obviously we don't want Bellingham doing the defensive work. You go and do the creative work. But I think Southgate didn't support him properly until Maignan came on, and then maybe there was a bit more balance. But I think there's still that, in transition and defensively, I felt like England were a little bit weak. I don't know if you agree, Adam. Were there any other concerns from the performance?
I think it was probably very lackluster in terms of the lack of imagination from an England perspective. I did feel like it was missing some kind of spark, someone that could kind of drive the ball a little bit more. And it was very reliant, I think it was very evident in the second half where everyone kind of went into that final third and was expecting the centre-backs to do something about it, like create some sort of long ball, like long divisional kind of ball. And it was never going to be that kind of game, because what was interesting to see, as much as we talked about or have been talking about England and the fact that they weren't maybe clinical or just not really at their kind of A game, I didn't see much from Brazil either, vice versa. I felt they kind of almost felt that England were a threat, and you could see they were putting men behind the ball and then looking to counterattack a lot. So it was interesting to see that kind of style of play from Brazil, because I think we expected them to be all gung-ho, you know, showing us their kind of talents. And it was kind of a very solid looking Brazil side. It wasn't spectacular by any stretch of imagination. Yes, they've got attacking outlets up top, but actually I felt that it was interesting the approach that they took. And I think the fact that England lost took a lot of that kind of shine off Brazil's performance, because everyone could kind of isolate England and kind of chat about how Southgate got it wrong, for example. And it's interesting, I think this probably resets the, like you alluded to earlier, about the fact that people comparing England and France, saying we're on the similar levels, well, actually that may reset that kind of focus and actually highlight that England need to work on a number of different things, including how they kind of work in those sort of situations. It didn't feel like they had a plan, didn't know what to do in those sort of circumstances, which was interesting. Highlighted probably that Sam Gallagher tries too hard in that middle of the pitch. I think he was overdoing it at times. And when Kobe Maignan came on, he seemed to make it seem easier. Like, obviously, he didn't seem as stressed out in comparison to Sam Gallagher in terms of that.
Yeah,
it's gone.
He's a lot calmer on the ball, isn't he? He's a lot like, he's just a lot calmer on the ball. And I think I saw someone describe him as the only English player who has like la pausa, like he takes the break before he gives the ball. And I think he just instantly looked perfectly at home, and I think I would be thinking of him as he's made a case for a starting midfield spot, I think, because there's a lack of options there at the moment. I also think, and alluding to your point about not really having a plan, I think there was like, and again, I'm biased, Saka is the greatest player ever, right? But you take Saka out of the right wing and all of a sudden there's no width in the England team. There was zero width. Like, I feel like Foden prefers to float into the central spaces. And instantly everything just went narrow and everything became predictable. And I think what Southgate and what these games are meant to be for, so we'll see how he lines up against Belgium, is about experimenting and seeing, right, okay, well, we need to see what we can work with. And I think we do need to look at how or what the alternative is if Saka can't play, because he's already, alongside Harry Kane and Declan Rice, I think, become the key players for England at the moment, that if they're fit, they start. And I think we need to think of an alternative for if Saka can't play, because it instantly took out all width and a lot of the unpredictability from the England team. And I think that's why Brazil found it so easy. Like, three of their back four, they were making their debuts for Brazil. Like, this wasn't a full strength Brazil team, right? Wendell from Porto, who was fantastic, and I absolutely really would like him at Arsenal. But like, on his debut, you should have someone absolutely roasting him, running at him, making him uncomfortable. And we just weren't able to get that. So I think Southgate needs to think about what the actual alternatives are. And I'll be intrigued to see how he does line up against Belgium, and if he does kind of experiment a bit, because that's what these games are meant to be for us learning things, right? Otherwise it is just a complete waste of time. But we do have a question from Matty Kushner. Thanks for getting involved, mate. Speaking of that, we are all saying how bad the defense is. Who is your starting back four or three? Well, Adam, I'll go to you first, and I'll hang till last.
I was disappointed that Southgate didn't kind of give a run out to Braithwaite, because I would have loved to have seen how he would have done. And the rumours are potentially he will start tomorrow as the left-sided centre-back. So based on current form, then I would go Braithwaite, Stones, and probably Kyle Walker, just because I think he seems to do a lot better when he's in the free, also adds that pace and injection to kind of cover when needed to. But also feel he's the creative element that potentially England centre-backs, obviously we kind of really rely on Johnny Stones to kind of step out of that defensive line. But actually, sometimes you need someone that can kind of provide that width as well. So I think between the three of them, that would be quite an equal balance. There's probably an argument to say Joe Gomez probably could stand a chance on current form, because he can play that left-hand side as well. I wouldn't have that personally, but that would be my three, because actually I'd prefer to see a lot more of a kind of concentration potentially down that width as well. So you've got those kind of wing backs potentially playing a lot more of a stronger part and potentially to drop back when needed to as well. But that'd be my choice.
Ben?
It's so tough. And I think the more I think about it, I think England have got more problems to solve. Then bear in mind, I think this is the best quality potential England squad that we've had in any of the tournaments that Southgate has managed us for by a long way. But I actually think we've got the most problems that need solving going into a tournament in any of these tournaments that he's been in charge for. I think there's, I just think that part of those are down to the moment, because that, you know, down to fitness and all those kind of things. But I'm worried about how we kind of balance this team. I'm worried about the defence. I'm worried about the midfield. And I think those two things affect each other in terms of this question about who is your starting back three or four. Because I think a lot of it depends on me. A lot of it for me depends on how you want to line up in midfield. Because personally, I think you have to find a way to fit Trent into this team. I just think that in a major tournament, I think the quality that he's got, I think he's another match winner. He's been that for Liverpool for goodness knows how long now. He's doing that. He's especially this season, he's kind of gone up another level. And you can talk about his defensive ability till the cows come home. But I think that's why I'd be more inclined to go to a back five, because I think that you've got the flexibility with Trent, where actually I saw a video from James Alcott where he kind of presented five different tactics as to how England win the Euros. And I never thought about playing Trent on the left-hand side. And it's on the face of it, you don't really understand. It doesn't really make sense. But the more you dig into it, in terms of some of the passes that he wants to play over the top, he's got, it almost opens up the pitch a little bit more for him if he's playing on the left rather than the right. But I think what I would potentially go for, I would potentially, if you, you know, nailing colours to the mast, if the tournament was tomorrow and everyone was fit, I think I'd go with a back five of Trent as a right wing back, but essentially being allowed the freedom to go into midfield. Walker as that right sided centre back, who then in possession, you go into a four and he becomes the right back. I'd have Stones and I'd probably have Braithwaite. I think for me, it's a toss up between him and Colwill, because I think you need that right foot, left foot balance. I just think for the way that you want to play and playing out from the back as well and having your centre back step into midfield. But I'd probably go with Braithwaite just on form. I think he's very composed on the ball, has a great passing range, and he's just a unit. I think he's a really good defender. And I think this could be a tournament where he gets in and stays in from the start. But then it's like you think about Maguire and it's just that he probably just will go with Maguire. Then I would go with Luke Shaw. I think it has to be, because I think in a four, he can then tuck in and play as that left back. But he also, we've seen he's played in a five for England before. He likes to bomb on. And I actually think with the balance of, like, you, I think this is kind of going all over the place, but what you said about Saka, I think is really important, because he is becoming one of England's most important players. And I still think, as much as I think Phil Foden has arguably been the best player in the Premier League this season, for England, it still hasn't quite worked. And I think the way you get the best out of Foden for me is, I think, by playing him on the left. So he doesn't kind of come in Saka's space, because I think Saka has the ability to hold the width to allow Trent to come inside and operate in that those sort of inside pockets, is that, you know, inverted fullback or midfielder or whatever you want to call it. But I think having Shaw to be able to go up and down that flank, and then that him holding the width on that side, allowing Foden to sort of come in and play more in those central areas. Because you look at Germany and you look at what they've kind of outlined, and we'll speak about the Germany-France game, and it was actually Wirtz that kind of grabbed the headlines with that stunning goal. Nagelsmann's ploy is to play Musiala and Wirtz in those half spaces high up the pitch and have your best two young players there to be able to dictate the game.
Yeah.
And I think that with the intelligence that Bellingham and Trent and Foden have all got, I think you can make that work in a way that Trent can step into midfield, Bellingham can do the box-to-box but also arrive late and be that number 10, and Foden can drift in from the left with Shaw holding the width, and Saka can hold the width on the other side but also come inside, and Trent's clever enough to go around the other side. I know, just for me, like, I think in terms of having the best quality players available on the pitch, I think it probably is a five. And I know it doesn't sound sexy, but I think with the players that you've got there, like I said, I think this is the best quality squad that Southgate's got, but I think he's also got the most, he's got the most amount of questions to answer going into the tournament. I think he has had, in terms of tactics and personnel and all that stuff. I think that's personally what I'd go with. It'd be Trent, Walker, Stones, Branthwaite and Shaw for me.
Well, in the third opinion, I'm going to stick with four at the back. I think England have played some of their best stuff in a 4-3-3. But I would... this is so... I know that I'm just going to come across as the annoying Arsenal fan, but deal with it. I would be on the phone calling Ben White saying, I'm sorry, and getting him back in the fucking squad, because he's the best right back in the league at the moment. He's on form. He's the best right back in the Premier League. I think he has to be there. The partnership that he has with Saka anyway, and the fact that they can just bounce off each other, they can find each other's runs. Ben White knows when to stop, when... The relationship there, you've instantly got that set out. So I would have Ben White at right back. It's difficult to say that. I would have John Stones, of course, because he's the best ball-playing defender, solid. And I think even some of the passes in the Brazil game that you saw him pull off, you're like, oh, God, there's not been many English players that can do that. I do want a left-footed left centre-back, so I think I give Braithwaite a go, because I think it instantly just adds that solidity and that dimension to your defence, that you can find those passes, gives you a bit more range. So I think Branthwaite, I'm definitely giving the left centre-back spot to. Again, I hope we see him in the Belgium game and see how he responds, because you can't just throw him into a tournament and be like, go. But I think in a perfect world, I would have him. And then left-back, if he's fit, it has to be Luke Shaw. I don't think there's many other... options. Like, again, Reece James, if he could play longer than 30 minutes, has probably got a shout. But I think it has to be Luke Shaw. But I think England have played their best stuff 4-3-3. I think it allows us to get the most out of our attack and the midfield there. But maybe this is part of the problem for Southgate. Everybody you ask comes with a different answer, right? And I think it's kind of half the problem.
That's the thing. I think it's like that's what I'm saying. I think he's got the most amount of quality, but the most amount of problems almost because of that. And then, like you said, you forget about players like Reece James, who I just don't think has got a hope in hell. I just think there's, as much as I love Reece James, and I think on his day, I think he could be the best option. I really think he could be. But that day just doesn't come anywhere near enough. And I think you're right about Ben White as well. I think not even just necessarily, because I think as much as Ben White has been amazing, he would then find himself in a queue of players to start. Because like you said, a couple of years ago, England could... Or the conversation for the last couple of years has been the fact that England could field an 11 of right back. So, as much as how good he's been for Arsenal, he wouldn't necessarily go in as first choice. Mm-hmm. But I think what Ben White does give you is that flexibility that is so important in major tournaments. Ben White, I think he could play in midfield. Because one of the big problems as well is that what are you going to do if Rice picks up an injury between now and the end of the season? Because they've got no one to play there.
Well, I'm going to cry if that helps. I'm going to cry.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be short-term relief for me, but then as soon as the season finishes, it's like, oh. But I think that's a major problem for England. Like a major. Bear in mind, like you look at... I made a video this morning on TikTok talking about the fact that, and as much as I don't want to give Arsenal players praise, I was talking about the fact that there's this documentary that's coming out about the England. Have you seen about this? About the trouble on the final of the Euros and the fans breaking into the stadium.
Yeah.
I made a video sort of talking about, I still think the biggest crime on that day was taking Declan Rice off in that final. And we lost all control then. And I think that was Declan Rice 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And Declan Rice has gone on to be potentially twice as good now as he was then, and that's scary because of how well he was playing in that tournament. He was England's best player in the summer by a mile in that year in the Euros. And I do really worry about England if Rice was to pick up a knock or something, or get a suspension. Who knows? You know, pick up a couple of yellow cards. I can't remember how it works with yellow cards, but say if he was to get sent off in the quarterfinal, then what are you going to do? Because you've got no one to step in there and play that role. Yeah. Calvin Phillips, by the looks of it, isn't going to go. Jordan Henderson will be in the squad. That's another conversation, but he will be there. We all know that. Yeah. He can't hold down that sixth position on his own, especially if you're playing France or Germany or Portugal or Spain in the quarterfinals. I just think we've got major, as optimistic as I am and as optimistic as I will be come June, you know, St. George's Cross or no St. George's Cross, England have got major, I think we've got major problems that I think haven't really come to light yet. And I think, again, it's how do you get the best out of Bellingham? How do you get the best out of Foden? It's almost like there's too much quality. And I know that sounds bizarre. Mm. And I just don't, this is where I think now you can fairly start questioning Southgate. I've always been a fan of Southgate. I think that what he's done for England in terms of the bigger picture and getting England fans back on side and all that sort of stuff and how far he's took out, you can't look at his reign as a failure. But now this is where big questions need to be asked. Mm. And I just worry about the management of this squad because I think there's so much quality, but there's so many holes, I think.
Yeah. I find the Trent shout really interesting. And Adam, I'm going to go to you because I feel like I forget about him as an England player. And I think he's a player that in 20 years, it'll be like Glenn Hoddle when everyone will go, how did he only get 10 caps for England? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like he's just massively not appreciated and we should be finding a place for him? Because he is categorically one of England's best, most talented technical footballers, but we just can't seem to find a place for him. I don't know if it's because he plays for Liverpool. I don't know what it is. Liverpool fans will say it's because he plays for Liverpool. Well, I don't know what it is, but do you feel like a spot needs to be found for him, right? And maybe he could do that midfield role and just start him in midfield.
I agree. I think everyone's kind of been so, I suppose, they want to pick a fault at his game, right? And for years, all they've kind of alluded to is that he's not very good on the one-on-ones. For example, defensively, he can be a bit short. But there's so many positives that can be gained from his outlet, his pace, for example. But his precision from crosses, from passing ability-wise, far exceeds his kind of weaknesses, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And I suppose when you look at how Liverpool managed to adapt to those kind of circumstances, they give him that freedom. They appreciate that there is going to be times where he's going to be obviously maybe the weak point in their team and, you know, he's going to be targeted. But I think over time, he's actually got better and better. And it's maybe something that hasn't been highlighted as much, maybe this season more so. But he's started to come up with a lot more of that kind of quality precision in terms of his game. I don't think we've maybe seen that kind of isolation as much this season compared to last season. Mm-hmm. So I genuinely think I'm back Ben with his kind of idea on this, that he should be the wing back. He should be the chosen kind of wing back. And if we're kind of alluding to the fact that Kyle Walker would be that right-sided centre back, then that's going to be enough of a cover. Because if I was to say Maguire plays in that position, I'd be a bit more wary, right? I think that'd be calamitous for everyone involved. Right?
But this is the thing, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, I suppose, that because then every time a player runs past Trent, it's like, oh, it's because he's shit defensively. There's plenty of players who Maguire isn't solid defensively, right? But then he doesn't get, although he does get hammered, but it's not constantly that's the weak point of his game. People are like, no, you got to stick with him, you know, he's a good player, you got to keep going, don't be negative. But it just doesn't seem to be the same for Trent, and I'm not sure why. But I think if it continues in this way, it's going to be a player that we look back and go, how did we not find a place for him in the team? Because he's just absolutely fantastic. And as you said, Adam, he has got better defensively. And the whole thing about a squad is that you ask someone else, well, that's my weakness. Okay, well, I can help you out. And we all, you know, make up for each other's weaknesses. So surely you should be looking for that. I think, Trent needs to be in there. I would have him in the midfield, I think. I would have him in the midfield in a perfect world. But, plenty of headaches for Gareth Southgate, I suppose. We kind of covered it on Thursday, but I want to get angry. So let's talk about the St. George's Cross thing. It's hilarious, isn't it, right? So my favourite thing this week has been people retweeting it with suggested pictures to replace.
Oh, my God,
It's been absolutely fantastic. I think the one was an England flag. We're like, get the bags in, get the slags in. Absolutely brilliant. But I have enjoyed this week on Twitter seeing the anti-snowflake brigade become snowflakes. Adam, your personal highlights of this argument? I tried my hardest to stay out of it, honestly.
Do you know what? I've actually switched off from it.
Really?
I can't give it any time or day or any of my thoughts, to be honest, because as soon as I heard it, I felt what a non-story to be really bothered about. Yeah. Like, of all the things you could pick, and it's been highlighted, look, there's been previous kind of editions of England kits or GB kits, for example, where it's not actually been using the full St. George's Cross emblem or anything like that. And if you look at the templates, if you look at what Nike have done with previous teams or other teams, for example, even Poland, for example, we've got the Poland Federation on the back where St. George's Cross should be. So, you know, in Poland, we don't give a shit. We do not give a shit. We'd like an imaginative kit. I've already said this on Thursday.
I'd like something that's better than just
a standard template. So the fact that I actually think it's a nonsense kind of thing that people have read into it far too much to actually what it should symbolize, for example. The most important thing is, obviously, from an England perspective, is the three lions, right? I'm pointing to the Polish eagle, but that's the most important thing from a country's perspective. They don't give a shit about what's on the back. I mean, Jesus Christ, where's this come to?
It's hilarious because I don't know if you follow the comedian Alistair Green. He does shots to camera. He's fucking brilliant.
Yeah,
the video he did today, and he's like interviewing all these people. And then it was the one guy who likes football, and he's like, I couldn't give a shit, mate. I don't care. I could not give a shit. And it's just fucking brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. But Ben, I did see you slightly getting involved with that. I put up the Tommy Shelby putting my gun to my head because I was at the desperate point. But yeah, how have you reacted to the whole thing?
That was how I felt, but I just had to keep diving in because it was just there was more nonsense day by day, which just became hilarious by the end of it. I was exactly the same as Adam. Like, it's one of those things where you're scrolling through Twitter and it's like, oh, the New England kit's out, looks really cool. Like, the kits are great as well. It's just
beautiful.
Like, people, they've sold out quicker than any other kit, and people wonder why. People don't care about the St. George's Cross really because, like Adam said, there's been variations of the England kit which has had a play on the St. George's Cross in all different colors. There was the Umbro kit from, I think, 2012 Euro, or maybe it wasn't that
2010,
one.
2010, maybe?
It was
2004, wasn't it? On the shoulder.
And everybody talks about that as one of the best England kits ever because it was the golden generation. Mm. And I think it was 2011 where Umbro played around and had multicolored crosses dotted all over the shirt. The goalkeeper kit was the cross all over the thing in blue. It was like, and they've done it to Brazil. They've done it to Adidas, have done something very similar with Scotland.
It's really
not that big a deal, but I think it's just an excuse for people to push very separate agendas that have got nothing to do with football, about their own beliefs and stuff. And I think that's been the saddest thing about it. And I think the worst thing is that some of the just disgusting racism that we saw on Twitter throughout the week won't get anywhere near as much of the press because this country doesn't want to have difficult conversations. That's what it's about. They'd rather stick fucking, what's his name, Tom Skinner, the guy from The Apprentice on GB News in the morning to debate. Literally. And it's like, usually, sometimes, like, I find him quite funny, but he wears very thin when he's been asked to actually speak up on serious things.
An opinion.
I don't want to hear your fucking political views, mate. I've got no interest. What makes you qualified to peddle your fucking semi-racist shite on daytime TV?
Exactly.
Blows my mind. I thought, you've got that thing where you say, Bosh. Just leave it at that, mate. Right, just leave it.
The worst thing is that the people, it's so obvious that people like old fucking gammon men see a little bit of color and think must be gay or something. It must be something to do with the LGBT community. And it's like Joey Barton saying it was the bisexual flag. And it's just like, oh my God, like you're seeing what you want to see there. Yeah. Like, it's just because you're trying to push your own agenda, and it's just embarrassing. Like, I think the thing that didn't help Nike is that their handling of the situation, but the initial wording of it was a little bit clumsy. It was a bit odd. Like, it, you can just say they probably just shouldn't have publicized it, or like shouldn't have said it was a playful update because that makes it seem quite meaningless. And then there is a legitimate argument to say, maybe, why have you changed it?
But then by
saying why have you changed it, that implies that it's on every single England shirt that's ever existed, which is not the case. Yeah. I've got England shirts where there's no St. George's Cross on it at all.
Yeah.
It's just a small bit of detailing that, I just think if it bothers you that much, there are far bigger problems in this country that, like I said, the government and the politicians getting involved and the broadcasters getting involved, they don't want to have difficult conversations that are actually affecting people's lives. Like the open racism that we saw towards Tony Walker and Rashford for wearing earrings and leggings and saying they shouldn't be even playing for this country and all this sort of stuff. It was just like, none of that gets spoken about, but you want to get every single ex-pro on TalkSport to say, I wear the England flag with pride. Like Adam said, with the Poland shirt, that's not the Polish flag. Mm-hmm. You know, the coat of arms that Scotland wear is similar to the, it's got the Scottish flag on it, but it's not the Scottish flag. Republic of Ireland is the same. Wales are the same. It's the dragon. It's what represents the football team.
Yeah.
It's that people will go out and say, you want to wear the St. George's Cross with pride. That's never been the case. You can't wear it with pride if it's on the back of the shirt anyway. It's not as if it's like some really... It's a symbolic emblem of this country. But I think part of the problem is, and the way I feel about it personally, is that I don't really have any relationship with St. George's Cross because I think it's been manipulated and taken over or owned by like a lot of far right kind of groups in this country where it kind of loses the meaning. And I'm not a particularly patriotic person anyway, but when it comes to the football team, that sort of stuff is all separate. Mm-hmm. And I think, and also with Gareth Southgate's response, people interpreted that in the way they want to interpret it. Because I interpreted it actually as that he doesn't really care.
That's how
I took it. But like people were then saying that, you know, because he said, oh, because it's not got the red and white, so it's not the St. George's Cross. People then were like, yeah, do you tell him, Gareth? And he was like, I think you could tell by his demeanour that he really wasn't that fucked and he has other things to think about. It's just,
The kits are
lovely. That's just like...
It's a nice kit. It's a nice kit. And the thing is, because obviously I ended up talking to the missus about it and I was like, you know, they're going mad about this. And like culture wars... In Italy, it's bad, right? In Italy, it's bad for culture wars. It's really bad. But then you see it in the UK and you're like, okay, nobody does it like us. Like, we really know how to set up a culture war.
Hold my beer, basically.
It is just incredible. People must just be incredibly bored. I found it really, really depressing. And then, you know, like a joke that goes on for a while, it's funny, then it's not funny, then it gets funny again. It kind of felt like that. And towards the end, I was just like pissing myself, like looking at all these people. Now. Jamie O'Hara fucking crying over it and all sorts.
How many England caps did Jamie O'Hara get, by the way?
Too many. I don't know.
This is what I mean. You've got like second rate, like no disrespect, because it was funny because they had Stuart Pearce on TalkSport on Friday. And obviously, Stuart Pearce is probably the most proud Englishman ever. Yeah. So.
Peter Shilton afterwards, like,
with Stuart Pearce, like, Stuart Pearce didn't even sound that bothered. He was like, he sort of just sort of said, well, they shouldn't really have done it, maybe. I don't like he disagreed with it, but he wasn't up in arms. And arguably the most proud England player to ever play for this country, whose opinion that you should probably value over the likes of Darren Ambrose and Jamie O'Hara, who were on TalkSport saying you should boycott Nike. It's like, and this is another thing. Sorry,
this is probably why they're wearing Nike kits.
They've got Nike trainers on. Don't worry about that.
And this is the thing that this is going on. Like, you know, you can pick this argument apart till the cows come home with some of the stuff they're saying. But like, people then blaming Nike for it and saying that Nike are a disgrace. It's this American company.
Woke company, mate. Woke.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the irony in that, as you kind of touched on at the start, of like the people that will sit around calling people woke and snowflakes getting upset over a literal piece of cotton on the shirt, was like, there was a tweet that banged that said that, which was the best kind of part of the discourse. But like, people blaming Nike for it, it's like, well, the FA would have approved it. If the FA, you know, they're the ones that represent the football team, like, they approved it. Don't get angry at Nike. It's like,
brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. And I've already seen, and I don't want to give him, you can sponsor us if you want, but there's a balcony shirts and they've already got a t-shirt with that flag on it with Ingerland underneath, which I'm definitely going to buy at some point before we go to the Euros. I'm getting that t-shirt, definitely. But let's leave that debate there. Just very quickly, let's talk about Brazil. I was quite impressed by Brazil. I thought they were... On the break, particularly, they didn't really play that Brazilian style of football, but they haven't for a very long time. But I thought on the break in particular, if Vinicius Jr. had a little bit more end product, I think he had a bit of a difficult night. But I thought there were a few players that stood out. Paquetá, apart from he should have been sent off, was by far their most dangerous player. And you kind of see, you're starting to see him at his full potential. Maybe you're starting to get more towards his potential. Like Adam, we're really seeing Paquetá, what Milan wish Paquetá had been, right?
Yeah, all those seasons ago. But he started to show a lot more ability, hasn't he? He's starting to, I suppose, maybe that influence from David Moyes has helped him out massively, because that element I think he alluded to in an interview was that he's tracking back. He wouldn't have done that back in Milan or Lyon, for example. So he's added that element to his game. He's become a bit more solid in terms of his contribution game by game. You know, it's not like one game is amazing, one game is subpar, for example. He's a lot more consistent with his game. I actually felt players like Gomez and Gumeresh actually played really well. Although we talked about how good Declan Rice was in that midfield, I actually felt they bullied England's midfielders. You know, they didn't let them kind of dominate that kind of play. You saw Bellingham really struggle to get into this game, for example. So I think they did a really good job. But even when we're kind of alluding to the fact that there's no Alisson, for example, you know, there's no Marquinhos in that defence as well. You know, these players that came in just show that there is a depth with Brazil. I think that was kind of escaped a few seasons ago, you know, when Brazil have been struggling at World Cups. But yeah, I still feel like we didn't see the best of Brazil. We didn't see a lot of it, but it was interesting to see their approach. And it just felt like they were just a bit more happier and calmer in those kind of situations, you know, whereas I suppose England were starting to get panicky. They didn't know what to do with the ball. And I think that's the difference in terms of that international football, that they seem to adapt quite quickly and they seem to be more at home, which was surprising when you consider like a lot of those players don't necessarily play in the Premier League. So that was interesting food for thought.
Yeah, and we saw two players, Ben, that everyone's excited about, Endrick and Savio, who we are very soon going to see grace the Premier League as he's going to come across to Man City. He only had a bit of a cameo, but he looked fairly exciting. Looks like another Julian Alvarez-esque player that City have just found, and he's going to be world-class within a week, right?
Yeah, you just know it. Some of these players come to City with almost that real lack of pressure, in a way. And I think that's why the players like Alvarez, who they've brought in from River Plate, and when they brought Jesus in at the start, like relatively unknown names, and it's obviously very clever scouting, but they're coming because of the stars that are already there. And you'd argue that the position that they find themselves in the table in the Champions League, there is that pressure. But for those players coming in, I think there is that little bit of freedom, and I think that we'll definitely see that from him. Endrick was an interesting one because, like you said, he's a player that has been talked about maybe more than a lot of other players over the last sort of 6 months in terms of the hype around him, but nobody's really actually seen anything of him. It's just been, you know, the links to, obviously he'll be going to Madrid and, you know, the YouTube clips and all that sort of stuff. He's, like you said at the start of the show, like he's very stocky. Like I didn't expect that physical build from him at all. Yeah. You know, I quite like the fact that there was a moment where I think he'd only been on for a couple of minutes before the goal, and he tried that piece. It might have been at 1-0 actually. He tried that piece of skill to get around the fullback, and it didn't quite come off. But I quite like that. I like the fact that he came out there with that confidence, and not to bring it back to England for a sec, but like that's what I really enjoyed about Mainu as well, was that the fact that Endrick had that same sort of thing. And obviously he's more of that flair player anyway, so you're naturally going to get that confidence. But Mainu didn't look phased at all. And you kind of mentioned about the Lapauza, like, just take a second. Just, you know, he's scanning. He's just taking it all in, just like very calm in that midfield. And I think obviously Endrick is on the other end of the spectrum in terms of the style of play. But I think we saw similar from him in terms of the goal was a bit messy, but he was there and he scored. It was a big moment for him. It's interesting that, Adam, you picked up on, obviously you spoke about Guimarães and João Gomes. João Gomes has been so impressive for Wolves. Mm. And I think everyone's talking about the fact that Wolves were in financial trouble and that Pedro Neto will most likely be off in the summer to kind of raise those funds. I would not be surprised if a top team comes sniffing around João Gomes. Yeah. He's been super impressive and he kind of dictated a lot of the game with Guimarães in there on Saturday. So, Brazil, it's almost like they've learned a little bit from, we were talking about it earlier before we sort of got onto the England discussion about how compact and played basically a counter-attacking side against England. And it's almost like, because Brazil haven't had a lot of success at all over recent years, and Argentina have dominated South American football, winning the Copa America, then the World Cup, and it's obviously the Copa America on the horizon this summer. It's almost like they've learned a little bit from that. And obviously with the loss of Neymar as well through injury, obviously they've got Vinicius, who is that flair player, Endrick coming through. But they feel like the most functional Brazil team, I feel like, we might have seen in a while. And obviously when you've got Richarlison to add back into that as well, who isn't a flair player, he's so effective for Brazil because he's a kind of more of an old-fashioned number nine, make it, you know, get it up there, hold it up, bring other players into play. And he scores a lot of goals for Brazil and it works. But when you kind of counteract that with the freedom that Paquetá has been given, and I think going into the Copa America, he might go in there as one of the most important players. So didn't feel perfect from them. Like you said, debuts at the back for the defenders, but I think there is a lot to be excited about for this sort of new look Brazil going forward. I think what that team could look like in a couple of years at the World Cup will be very interesting.
Yeah, I think they're still waiting for Ancelotti to take the job. Their manager there is very much like a kind of placeholder. But yeah, I was really, just really happy to see Endrick for once actually playing. I was like, right, here we go. Let's see what this guy's all about. And yeah, I was really impressed with him. Really, really impressed with him. Good stuff. Let's leave England-Brazil there. We got a lot out of that, guys. Good work. And we're going to talk about, very quickly, I suppose, Italy going stateside with two wins. And, well, everybody here is delighted. Every Italy fan I've talked to at work has just been like, what the fuck was that? What have these performances been? Nobody's impressed. It's been two very different, completely different 11s, I think, in both teams. So he's using the break what it's for, right? He's kind of experimenting fully, Spalletti, and seeing what he's got in his hand. Most of the rage, to be honest, was about them going to America in the first place. A lot of the fans were really pissed off about that. But two wins, Retegui getting two goals in the first game against Venezuela. I think that's now four goals in five caps for Italy. A really impressive start for him. And then Pellegrini in the third minute and Barella in the 94th to get a 2-0 win over Ecuador. But I think one of the most interesting talking points here, Adam, is the goalkeeping spot. Donnarumma saving a penalty, of course. But within that performance, you could see his weakness with the ball at his feet. You really could see how he gets exposed, right? And then, of course, Ben, well, I'll come to you for Vicario in a moment. But do you think Donnarumma, Adam, impressed enough there? Or do you think that spot is fully up for grabs?
I still think it's up for grabs. I don't think he's particularly comfortable with Donnarumma. Obviously, he's got, I suppose, the experience behind him in the number one jersey for the Azzurri national squad. But I think there's been a lot of question marks about his performances, not just like in this friendly, for example, Rory, but actually generally in the campaign as well. You know, I think there was a few mistakes that led to goals, for example, against the likes of Albania, was it? I think something like that. In a friendly
North Macedonia as well.
So there's been a few examples like this where he's been let down in terms of the way he approaches the game. And I've noticed he does a lot more of that kind of footwork with PSG as well, which I think he's trying his best to do better at that kind of side of his game. But that's not his natural game. He's actually better at just kicking it long and, you know, getting it onto a target man's head, which I think in Italy's kind of game, they're lacking that. It was a shame that Lorenzo Lucca, for example, was injured because I think he stood a great chance of maybe showing what his credentials were for the national squad. But to your point, I think there's going to be a good chance that there could be someone else as number one, whether that's like Vicario or whether that's Carnesecchi. Obviously, you know, Meret's credentials as well from Napoli. So, it's interesting, isn't it? I think there's a huge dilemma. You've got so many great goalkeepers. Di Gregorio, who we haven't even mentioned, who plays for Monza, having a fantastic season there. And as you alluded to, even Provedal. He's such a serially underrated goalkeeper. So, yeah, lots of food for thought. But it's great that actually he explored it. He went with Vicario in the next game as well. So, great chance for him. And to that kind of point, I think Italy did a good job of actually rotating that squad. I think that was really good and really well for us. So I suppose the question would be, did we actually learn too much about these players? Probably not a lot because the opposition didn't really give them too much. Test but them. I think there was a lot of mistakes in that performances between the two.
Yeah, well, I think this is the thing. It's been treated as a marketing exercise really more than like a actually getting opponent that's anywhere near preparation for a European tournament. But Ben, Vicario, he could be Italy's number one. He's accused sometimes of being a little bit lightweight, but do you think he has what it takes to be able to step up and take that number one shirt?
I think so. I think a lot of that is kind of borne out in his mentality. You can see how much he wants that. I was I was really pleased for him to see him get his debut because I think he's definitely earned it. And I know obviously as a Spurs fan, there's going to be that element of that within that, but he's been super, super impressive. There's obviously been kind of jibes for him a little bit from those where we had that run of games where he was bombarded from corners where actually my view on that, and obviously you could accuse me of kind of trying to protect him, but I think it's just, I don't think Spurs did a good enough job of protecting him in those situations. I think he looked a bit flappy, but it's because there wasn't really that barrier in front of him and he looked a bit vulnerable. But I actually think we haven't seen anything like that since. And I think it was obviously, I think again, not to sound kind of too biased, but there was a couple of those games where it wasn't like teams were sticking a man on Vicario. It was like teams were putting a train together to go on Vicario. And like, I remember against Brentford where they were pushing everyone almost back into the goal, and Everton were doing the same against us and whipping in balls of real quality. So that's naturally going to expose you a little bit. There is definitely something to work on, and Vicario is not the perfect goalkeeper, but I've been so, so impressed with him. And I think, like I said, I think his mentality has been such a welcome addition to Spurs as well. But I think if you think about Italy and you think about the characters that have played for them over the years, I think that's what he has over Donnarumma. I don't see that with Donnarumma. I see Donnarumma as a presence in the sticks. He's not, for example, as an England fan, he's not someone you want to go up against in a penalty shootout because of his frame. He's huge. He feels like this immortal kind of giant in goal. But I think in terms of what Vicario brings to the team, I think he brings a little bit more calmness. I think he brings a little bit better quality in terms of passing out from the back. I think he's potentially as good a shot stopper as Donnarumma on his day. And I do think there's the natural path there for kind of Vicario to take over. I remember Buffon speaking about Vicario a couple of years ago when he was, it might have been before he was at Empoli.
Or maybe
it was when he was at Empoli, sort of saying about this guy is going to be the Italy number one. And I think is it Empoli that have produced a lot of goalkeepers?
Empoli have produced a lot of good players in general, to be honest. But yeah, they've had, who was the other keeper that was there?
Provedal.
Yeah, Provedal came through Empoli as well, didn't he? Yeah.
So, they have had a few. But Italy are an interesting one as well, because I think I was looking at this the other day. I can't remember who they've got in the group. I feel like they're in Spain's group.
They've got Spain, Albania, and I should have the groups up, really. They've got a very difficult group.
Yeah, so it's going to be, and this kind of rotation of the two sides was interesting, because it wasn't as if it was like, this is the A team, this is the B team. There were kind of sprinklings of each in both of those sides, which I think is quite interesting. Obviously, again, from a Spurs perspective, you've kind of got a doggy up against DiMarco. I think DiMarco is, as much as a doggy, is fantastic. I think if you're going to play five at the back, you probably couldn't find a better left wing back in Europe at the moment. And I think with the experience that DiMarco's got, I think a doggy might struggle to get in there. But it was good to see him get minutes. He bizarrely wasn't even in the squad for the second game, which kind of threw Spurs Twitter into a bit of a frenzy, because he hadn't been seen in training. And it was like, oh, here we go again. But yeah, it's interesting with, obviously, Raspadori played in that second game. Pellegrini got the goal. Barella into midfield with Jorginho. And then the midfield in the first game was Locatelli and Bonaventura. So the depth is there. And you think about how good Locatelli was in the last Euros. Obviously, I mean, the insane depth at Italy. I think you've got Spinazzola. I can't remember if Spinazzola's out.
Spinazzola, yeah. No, well, it's always hard to remember if he's fit or not.
Yeah, exactly.
I think he's fit at the moment, but Roma are like, don't touch him.
You've got him to add to that depth as well at left wing back. It's just crazy. They're a bit top. It's a bit like England. They're kind of top heavy in a lot of positions.
Yeah, well, you kind of neatly taken us onto where I wanted to go next, which was Adam with the wing backs. I think it's really interesting because he had, as Ben said, he had Cambiasso and Udogi in one game. Mm-hmm. Then he had, I'm trying to remember all the names now,
Bellanova
in the second game, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, they've got a real wealth of talent there, Italy. Like, who are your starting wing backs? We know that in Spalletti's system, the wing backs are super important. You can see how much he got out of Di Lorenzo at Napoli, right? Like, who are your starting wing backs for Italy? Because I think there's a really interesting battle there.
I think actually I'd rotate it depending on the opposition personally, because you've got DiMarco, who isn't necessarily quite fast or has the stamina to last a whole game, for example. But his kind of crossing ability and his shot from distance is kind of really powerful. So he's going to be useful on those occasions. He's almost kind of compared to that David Beckham kind of style of role, because he can ping those balls quite well. And then you've got Udogi, for example, who I do love. I actually think he should be given a lot of opportunities with the Azzurri squad. It's a shame we didn't see Kayode, for example, being picked for this squad. I think he would have been a really good addition for that right-hand side, just to kind of challenge Di Lorenzo, because I think it would be Di Lorenzo personally. Raul Bellanova's had a great season with Torino. And, you know, I think Inter will be gutted that they let him go as well, in that sense, because they only had him on loan from Calgary last season, but could have made it a permanent. And I'm sure they'll be kicking themselves. Cambiasso, you can't dispute what a great season he's having with Juventus. But I don't know if he kind of forces himself into this squad. Mm-hmm. This is the only problem as well. So a lot of question marks. I would personally say left-hand side, definitely Udogi and DiMarco as the kind of two to kind of rotate. On the right-hand side, I feel it's going to be Di Lorenzo and personally, I think it's probably going to be Cambiasso because mm-hmm. he's more consistent versus Bellanova. But at least you've got depth, I suppose. That's the great thing about it. So.
Yeah, and then finally up front, like Retegui, you can't really argue with his numbers. Like I keep waiting for him to, like, so I think there's something there where it's not going to work. And he's had a very good season with Genoa. He's having a very good time with Italy. Like he has to be ahead of Raspadori, right? Ben, are you taking him ahead of Raspadori? I think he's just got a bit more of a constant threat, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, especially when it feels like the drop off then from Raspadori. Is then you're looking at someone like Scamacca as well. Like the options for Italy up front aren't exactly the most inspiring. Yeah. So I think that you have to go with Retegui just purely based on form and numbers. Again, bagging two goals on Friday. It's such a difficult barometer these games because was it Venezuela and Ecuador that they played? So it's not as if you're getting that same anywhere near that kind of same test. And I think the summer for Italy, I think, is going to be more about the players around that. I think it's going to be whether the players, like obviously Chiesa played on the game on Friday, but with the kind of up and down season that he's having, or not really even up and down, just the kind of disappointing season that he's having, really, like, is he going to be a guaranteed start? Yeah. You've then got Pellegrini, who's been more consistent. It's such a tricky one. I think it's going to be more about how they kind of supplement the attack behind whoever plays up front. Mm. Even though obviously that position is important, I think it's about those players buzzing around Retegui or whoever it is up there. And I still think that's a problem that they kind of need to answer. You've got Fratesi as well. So I think they're going to be such an interesting team in the summer. I think there's a lot of teams, and obviously we're going to come on to France, Germany, but I think there's a lot of teams that people aren't really thinking about that might still cause teams problems. Nobody would have predicted Italy to go that far in Euro 2020 and they ended up winning it. So maybe with this kind of some of the fresh exciting players they got coming through and the old guard are still there to an extent, you know, they might surprise a few teams despite the difficult group they've got. So it's an interesting
I was looking at their group. They've got Spain, Croatia and Albania. That's a difficult group. Like Albania are a decent team. Like Albania are genuinely not as bad as you think they are. They are good. So I think Italy are going to have their work cut out, but I think you're right. They're going to surprise a lot of people. And with Spalletti, I think we've seen that tactically he is brilliant, and I think he will be able to. It's just seeing him go through tournament football. I suppose this is his first tournament. This is his first, like, right, let's see how this goes. So, yeah, I think Italy are going to surprise some people. It'll be exciting, and there are a lot of exciting young players there for Italy. So, good times. I was watching some of their youth teams this week because I was particularly bored, and Kamada, the player that everybody's been talking about for Milan, got a hat-trick or four goals against Belgium. Absolutely ran riot. That guy looks insane. All types of finishes, like heading with his left foot, right foot, just his movement, absolutely incredible. That was for the under-19s, I want to say, or the under-17s. Yeah. And then Pufundi for the under-21s as well was absolutely fantastic. He scored a great goal as well. And one observation that really kind of put a smile on my face, the face of the Italian team is about to change in the future because there's a lot of young black players coming through in the Italian youth teams that this country is going to have to face up to at some point. And I can't wait because they're incredibly talented and it's going to be a much more diverse Italian team. So I think it's going to be really, it's great to see. It's just great to see from an observational living in this country point of view. It kind of came to mind. But let's leave Italy there. Italian Americans were quite happy they got to see their team, I think. So that's all that matters. And let's go on to Wirtz and Havertz. Kai Havertz scores again. You can't stop him getting the second against France, but it's all about the start, right? Ben, 7 seconds in, France just hadn't woken up, right?
It was a ridiculous goal. Like I was saying earlier about the fact that I think sort of alluding onto what I was saying before about Italy, and I don't think Italy is necessarily in contention as Germany, but I think people seem to be not talking about Germany at all. Bear in mind, this is a host nation tournament. Some of the young, exciting players they've got coming through, and these aren't new players, but Musiala and Wirtz have been two of the best players in the Bundesliga this season. They are the players that Germany are going to build this team around. And then after Nagelsmann made that statement in the week, talking about those two players playing in the half spaces, being the guys to win that tournament for Germany, for Wirtz to then go and do that inside what felt like the first 10 seconds of the game, was crazy. And then from what I saw, obviously I didn't watch the whole game, but it felt like Germany kind of kept France at arm's length a little bit really. And then Havertz had a golden chance to score before he then scored the second anyway. Like, Germany are going to be I think Germany are going to be a real threat at this tournament. I know it sounds super obvious, but I just don't feel like, I feel like they're almost dark horses going into their own Euros, which sounds crazy to me. I know they're flattered to deceive at major tournaments over the last few years. They haven't got out of the group in the last two World Cups, and then England knocked them out in the round of 16 in the last Euros. And they may well flatter to deceive again with a young team. You know, it might be the pressure of being host nations. We know what it can get like with Germany. If you use Bayern Munich as kind of a microcosm for the German media and, you know, how kind of the shitstorm that goes on at Bayern sometimes. And that, it feels like there's that element of pressure with the national team as well a lot of the time. Focus on it.
I think at the moment it's different. I feel like there's zero expectation from the German fans at the moment because they've seen how poor everything's gone. And they're, like, we have to say, this performance against France is very much an outstanding result, right? Like, we all turned around and was like, whoa, what the hell happened there? I think their performances haven't been great. I think Nagelsmann is obviously figuring something out, but you have to remember the last game he played Havertz at left back, so he's clearly figuring shit out. But there's a lot of encouraging signs there. I really liked Mittelstadt at left back. I thought that was an interesting pick. Having a really good season for a very good Stuttgart team that are doing very well in the Bundesliga. So I think Nagelsmann is figuring stuff out. But I think they're going into the tournament with, like, zero pressure. I think, like, from podcasts I've listened to and, like, it feels like the Germans are kind of like, if we get out of the group, we'll take that as a success because we're not expecting much. But yeah, a lot of, I think he's kind of figuring it out. I think he's kind of figuring it out. And as I think Lineker said, never doubt the Germans, right? You know, they're always going to rock up at some point. And Havertz, a striker, I was very, very impressed with. But also, the kit is beautiful. The Germany kit, I'm a big, big fan of. I looked at it and I was like, I need to go and buy that shirt. It really is beautiful. But Adam, when you talk about France, is this just a bad day at the office? The team selection to me seemed a bit odd. Before I get on my Arsenal high horse, what did you think about France and their performance?
Reminded me a bit like England, really, where I think there's that little bit of arrogance that maybe, you know, you can rotate a few players and you can get away with it. And by the way, that goal that Germany scored, it's not the first time that they've been caught from a routine like that. Austria did the same to them, where they conceded quite quickly from a very similar kind of setup. So obviously it was something that Nagelsmann and that kind of background team did see a flaw in their game. And you saw Zaire Emery, for example, being picked in this game as well. I thought Didier Deschamps used this as an opportunity to rotate and play around with players. You know, we saw Marcus Thuram being kind of the focal point up top as well. But yeah, it did seem like a game where they did struggle. They did struggle, and there's a lot for them to maybe ponder and consider what their approach is going into this Euros, because yes, I think everyone kind of sees them as a favourite, but no one kind of dares to kind of try and beat them. And I think this was probably an eye-opening kind of game for Deschamps. You heard boos at the end of the game as well, because you could see French fans were disgruntled at that performance. They're not happy. They're not used to losing in this manner. And I think Germany really put it on them. And that, you know, whilst we're talking about how great Germany are, I think there's been a lot of distractions in the German national side. For example, they're going to end the association with Adidas for their kits and go to Nike, for example. That's a major kind of outburst of cry from the German national fans. They don't like this. And I think that's been helpful, because in recent, if you look at the last two friendlies, they lost 3-2 to Turkey, for example. Yeah. And they lost to
Japan
as well. As well as another example. So, you know, Nagelsmann needed a result out of this. And this, bear in mind, he hasn't got Leroy Sané as well. There's a lot of question marks about Ilkay Gundogan as well, his role. Where does he actually fit in this? Because he's no longer got the legs to kind of fulfill the defensive duties by all accounts, but he's played in a kind of attacking midfield play. Now, he did that kind of thing for Man City, but actually, can he do it on the national side? I've not seen him do it very regularly. And then you've got the rumours about Toni Kroos. Potentially, this is his last tournament as well.
They said that last time. They've had leg him out of retirement. We can't find anyone to replace you, Tony. You have to come back.
This is it. But I think Tchouaméni let it out in an interview. That's a kind of realistic idea that this will be his last tournament. And then when we're kind of joking about Germany, Niklas Füllkrug is kind of the backup striker, for example. So they haven't got that depth that maybe a few years ago they used to have. And it'll be an interesting period because they need to transition. But I think it's going to be whoever takes on the role after Nagelsmann, because we know his contract ends at the end of this tournament. Mm-hmm. And I think he wants a club role rather than the national job. So naturally, I think the successor is Jurgen Klopp. That's what apparently is the person that's been approached for this role. Whether that is legitimate, I don't know. But you could see him developing kind of the infrastructure, which is what Joachim Löw used to do. He used to love being able to tap into the different age groups. And I think they'll do the same. But yeah, huge question marks for France. But I don't think it's something that they should be too wary of. I think this is a blip. They needed that. And I'm sure Didier Deschamps will rethink his approach as well.
Yeah. My only issue here, and I know there's everyone's just about, oh, shut up about Arsenal. My only issue is I don't get why Saliba doesn't start and Upamecano starts. Every time I've seen Upamecano, he drops a clanger or he does something where you're like, whoa, this guy just has like, it feels like he just glitches a bit every so often. And he just collapses. And I think, I don't know what more Saliba has to do. And I saw that like Pavard was shifted from right back into centre back. I know he's been playing centre back for Inter in that back three, but it is that kind of right back centre back role he plays, so that he could put Koundé at right back, who's another centre back. And I thought, how many positions are you shifting just to not play William Saliba?
Just play really Saliba.
Saliba, right?
I'm going to say, especially like, it's a good point about Upamecano, because you see like in the Champions League last year, he had big cock-ups really when it got really tough against City, despite throughout the rest of the game actually looking pretty solid. And then in 10 minutes bells, it's just he looks like one of the most complacent defenders in the world. When you've got a Rolls Royce in Saliba sitting on the bench, it feels a little bit, going into tournament football where one mistake can change absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense. It feels like you said, I think that's spot on. Like they're kind of trying to fit too many square pegs in round holes to not play him. It seems a bit bizarre. I know there's been some stuff in the French media about Saliba. Was it Emmanuel Petit who came out and sort of spoke about the fact that he doesn't really fancy him for the national side?
He's always saying something.
Bet if you spoke to kind of the average French fan down the street, they'd probably ask you who your best centre-back option is, and they'd probably say Saliba. It just feels a little bit like, it feels like we've had these conversations with England with certain players where it's just like, just play him, find a way, figure it out. But this is a centre-back we're talking about. We're not talking about how do you get the best out of Trent. Is it playing him in midfield? Or is it playing him at fullback? Is it Foden in the 10 or out wide? This is Saliba, who's been arguably the best centre-back in the Premier League this season. It doesn't make sense. But for that reason, though, I kind of think like, I think France are gettable. I do think they're gettable. They seem inevitable because of they've got like the talent that they've got. I just think there is a little bit of a chink in their armor to a point. We saw that in the last Euros. I know this is a bit of a different team. Arguably, that team at the Euros was maybe more fully formed than this one is. With some of the players coming through now. They're still a massive threat, but no one's got their hand on it yet. I don't think the Euros. Whereas I think at this point it'd be a little bit clearer. Usually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like what we saw in this game was like when things don't go right, they just kind of go, right, well, Kylian, you've got to fix it. Like, and it's just it becomes very one-dimensional of just give it Kylian and hopefully he'll spam it top corner. So I feel like they don't really respond to, or they don't seem to have a plan B when things do go against them. I think you made a good point, like not many teams go to try and win against them. Like not many teams go for it. And Germany did, right? And they were like, right, no, we're going to try and win it and let's see what happens. So I think, they are get-at-able. My last thought on this, why the hell did Nottingham Forest not sign Bryce Samba to a frigging deal? The guy is an unbelievable goalkeeper.
He wanted to leave, though. He wanted to leave back to France. That was the reason.
Oh, I thought it was they couldn't offer him a contract.
They tried to keep him on, but he decided he wanted to come back to France. So,
that's their a hell loss. Of a miss. That
Lance's gain, wasn't it?
He was unbelievable. He made some unbelievable saves in this game, and I saw him for. He's at Lens now, right? So he played against Arsenal. Yep. He made some great saves for them as well. And I was like, is that the guy who won the playoffs for Forest? Incredible. What a miss that was. But finally, moving on, Adam, we're going to give you your time to shine. Here we go. The big game, mate. Here we go. Wales versus Poland in Cardiff. How are we feeling?
Confident is the word, because I didn't think I'd be saying this, and I didn't think I'd give a damn either going into this. But actually I am, because he gave me too much hope on that Thursday's performance. It was against Estonia, an Estonian side that's got Ragnar Klavan. Do you remember him for Liverpool? Oh, yeah. 38-year-old without a club playing against us. That was interesting. But yeah, I mean, Estonia were pretty poor. But what was interesting was the style of football that we actually played against them, which kind of gave me hope to kind of say, right, on the balance of play, this should be a very interesting game against Wales. I think if you look at the stats, Poland's have a very good record against Wales in Cardiff. On the last seven appearances in Cardiff, we've beaten them every time. The last time was 2 years ago in the Nations League, where we won 1-0, courtesy of Karol Swiderski, and that was Czesław Michniewicz's first game for Poland as well. So
the start of an incredible era.
What an era that was, right? But yeah, it's going to be an interesting matchup just in general. I feel on the balance of play, if you look at the squads, we probably have a little bit more quality in terms of the amount of players that play abroad and play for bigger clubs, for example. A lot of hype was made around the fact that Lewandowski didn't score against Estonia, but that wasn't because necessarily he wasn't on the end of opportunities. It was because he was just marked out of the game by at least three players around him at one time, which actually was great because it actually meant that we're not putting so much pressure towards him to deliver, a bit like you said with the France scenario of Mbappe, but actually other players are starting to contribute towards that game. Obviously, you mentioned about Lons. Frankowski's having a fantastic season down there, and he was the one that scored the opener. Nikola Zalewski, who's playing fantastically well for Roma, he contributed here and scored a goal against Estonia. And I know it's just Estonia, but that's the momentum we needed. We needed games like this. Under Probierz, who's the new coach for Poland, he plays a lot more kind of tactical football, play of style of football anyway. And he's kind of compared to like a Guardiola kind of philosophy. He likes to kind of play that tiki-taka football, but he likes to play really kind of pressurized style of football where he puts the defense under pressure, makes them crack. And you could kind of start to see that flow into the game. So I've got a lot of hope, but I am also conscious that Wales are coming off a good victory against Finland, but Finland caused them problems with Tuomas Pukki, for example. So I think there's a little chink in kind of Wales' armour to suggest that this is going to be a very open game between both sides. I don't think it's going to be Poland are going to completely dominate play, but based on that performance, that gives me a lot more confidence that we're actually going to potentially qualify. I don't think we deserve to based on our group stages. Let me put my hands up to that. But we had Fernando Santos in charge then, and that was terrible football. Now we completely look different. We seem rejuvenated, a lot more kind of thought about if we don't win this way, then we can change it up. And that's the promising bit for me. I'm happy that we're actually playing some decent football. And that's going to give a lot of pride to a lot of those players as well, because I think they were a bit annoyed from the World Cup under Michniewicz. Then they had Fernando Santos that didn't even speak a word of Polish, and probably apparently by all accounts used a translator to kind of talk to the guys at halftime, which wasn't enduring. Obviously, we've had Paulo Sousa that spoke in English, for example, but Fernando Santos even just rejected even doing that. So, yeah, it's interesting, but obviously, I'm sure Ben will allude to the fact that Brennan Johnson is in good form for Wales as well. Ben Davis being really strong at the back for Wales and commanding in terms of his performance. I feel for me where the weakness is in the likes of Joe Rodon. Obviously not as probably as solid potentially. And the goalkeeping situation is an interesting one for Wales as well. Brad Jones, obviously only being a reserve goalkeeper for Leicester City. So that gives a lot of doubts. And I don't think he's very stable at times.
But, no, I think this is, and this is kind of leads me neatly on to Ben. I'm going to ask you, I thought that, I don't think I was the only one in assuming that once Bale and Ramsey kind of faded away, this Wales would fade away, but they haven't, right? They've continued and they've got just a lot of steady ability, right? And I think the fact that a lot of their players were Premier League players, but they weren't playing regularly. Right. Whereas now a few of them have dropped down to the Championship or they've dropped down to different clubs, gone to difficult, and they're playing regular football. Like, it's impressive that Wales, and I say this as an Ireland fan, has been able to sustain a good team for a long period of time. Like, did you expect this era to come to an end? I've been surprised.
Yeah, definitely. I think Rob Page has done an incredible job to kind of keep them rejuvenated, really. Wales are one of the teams that you just wouldn't want to play, especially like going away to Cardiff.
In Cardiff as well, yeah.
Yeah, their fans are so up for it. They, you know, they love international football. They absolutely love getting behind the team. Like, you've seen that at tournaments, but you've seen that, you know, kind of in these knockout games as well. But obviously that was kind of exemplified even more with the likes of Gareth Bale, and kind of you had that maverick to get them to when they weren't playing so well. Because with Wales, it's always felt like a little bit disjointed when someone like Bale isn't there. And obviously Ramsey is still knocking around, I think, but
somewhere.
But the, you know, that front three on the surface is quite exciting. And Harry Wilson's had a great season for Fulham. I think he's really kind of found his, not to sound patronising, but I think he's found a level there where he can really perform on a consistent basis. The back three is an interesting one because Joe Roden and Ethan Ampadu have played together all season for Leeds and have been really, really solid. Obviously, we had Joe Roden at Tottenham. I always thought Joe Roden was going to be, I never thought he was going to be a star, but I always quite liked him from what I saw, and Mourinho fancied him and then sort of got left out in the cold. It, was, it wasn't managed particularly well with Roden. But again, like, I think he's massively found a really his level at Leeds and playing alongside Ampadu. But Ampadu steps up to play in midfield for Wales. So then you kind of lose that relationship. But I think Adam alluded to, and again, from a Spurs perspective, Ben Davis, I think being the captain of the national team now, you can see how much that means to him. Ben Davis is always going to give you a 7 out of 10. He's such a steady Eddie, like the sort of player that you need in that team, in the squad, and certainly in the team for Wales. And from a squad perspective for Spurs, like he's just such a great guy to have around, such a calming presence at the back, especially with younger players alongside him as well. The fullbacks, I think you lack a little bit of quality there with Nico Williams and Connor Roberts. I know, obviously, they've got a little bit of a Leeds trifecta going on with Roden, Roberts and Ampadu. Chris Meppham, I'm not particularly convinced of. And the goalkeeping situation is an interesting one because I think I heard on the radio the other day, all of the potential three or four goalkeepers that could play for Wales, none of them have played basically a minute for their clubs this season. So it's a bit of an interesting one. Obviously, you've got Wayne Hennessy, who's still knocking about. And then on the other end of the pitch, obviously, Brennan Johnson kind of tends to play through the middle for Wales. He got his goal the other night, just being a good poacher, kind of scavenger finish, being in the right area. And that's actually something that I was sort of thinking about making a video on it from a Spurs perspective about Johnson. And I really think that in a better quality team, I think that he can almost become what Raheem Sterling was to City in terms of his sensing of danger and his arriving at the back post. But for Wales, it's different. He's the focal point. And I don't think he's quite as good as that. But his record for Wales is pretty decent. And he'll be someone that will be looking to make an impact tomorrow. I think it's going to be a fascinating game. I think Wales may... Sorry, Adam. But I think Wales may just edge it just because of... I just think playing in Cardiff, they've got that home advantage. I just think they got that confidence in the win the other night. I think it might just be Wales, but it's going to be, it's going to be a fascinating game.
Yeah, they absolutely squeezed through against Ukraine, right? And I think it was the, for the World Cup, I think it was the atmosphere definitely helped. I've got like, I listen to a sports podcast, which is all Welsh people, and it's made me very, very biased towards Wales, but I really love their fan culture. I love that it's so inclusive. I love that it's like really just open-minded and welcoming. And like, if you've not listened to the song, what's it called? Amanohid. I apologize for my terrible French, Welsh there, but it's a really like, even if you don't speak Welsh, it gets the hairs on the back of your neck going. I think that they've really got that absolutely nailed. So I think going into that stadium is going to be, I'm excited to watch that game. I'm genuinely excited to watch that game. I think it's going to be a great one. Kivior versus Johnson. Warm up for the North London Derby in a few weeks. Kivior versus Johnson is going to be great to see. Jakub Kivior, I'm fully on board. But guys, I think that's everything. The other playoff games we do have very quickly, Georgia versus Greece. I think Poirier's contract expires about 5 minutes after the final whistle. They really are hanging on to that guy for too long.
Pack up your stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, but leave. And then the other one, another interesting one, I think, Ukraine versus Iceland. Ukraine genuinely a very, very good team. Iceland did everyone a favour in the last round, so we're all back in them. But yeah, Ukraine-Iceland, very, very happy. That will be a really interesting game as well. So it'll be great to see who gets through. If you do get through, as you said, Adam, the group is pretty tough on the other side, but it'd be great to be there, right? It would be great to be there.
Yeah, it'd be good to watch us lose every game, right?
it's just whenever Ireland qualify for a tournament, mate. Oh, we got there, right. How embarrassed can we get? So, guys, I think we've done all right with, like, no football this week. Good work, guys. Congratulations.
Nice one.
So... guys, thanks for joining us. Some of us will be back on Thursday, or one of us will be back on Thursday with a special guest, which is very exciting. I'm going on my holiday, so I will not be here. But I love you all anyway. Thank you for joining us. You can follow us on Twitter at Italian Anglo Pod, on Instagram at Anglo Italian Pod, and on TikTok at Anglo Italian Pod. As I said, we will have the show on Friday. Guys, anything to say before I let these people enjoy the rest of their evenings?
No, I mean, enjoy the football.
Try not to get too bored by England against Belgium tomorrow, because I feel like it's going to be another stinker. I genuinely might watch Wales against Poland.
I think you should. I think everyone should just watch that instead. You'll learn more.
Yeah. I'm definitely watching that one. Well, thank you for joining us, guys. Don't forget to hit the like and subscribe button, and we will see you on Friday. Ciao. Alla prossima.
Ciao, ciao.
Podcast Network.